And we're back on Off the Hour. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Aaron Lakoff, and I'm joined with Leif Maroof of Under the Olive Tree. And we're here in the studio today with our very special guest, Professor Norman Finkelstein. Norman is a professor at DePaul University in Chicago, where he teaches political theory. He is the author of 5 books, including his most recent one, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. Norman will be giving a lecture tonight at McGill University entitled Israel and Palestine, Misusing Anti-Semitism, Abusing History. That will begin tonight at 7:30 p.m. in the Stuart Biology Building of McGill University, which is 1205 Dr. Penfield. Welcome to the program, Professor Finkelstein.
Thank you for having me.
So we're gonna have a bit of a discussion, and then we will also invite callers to call in if they have any questions. You can reach us here in the studio at 514-398-4616. Your lecture tonight, Professor Finkelstein at McGill, again, is entitled Israel and Palestine, Misusing Anti-Semitism and Abusing History. Can you explain the thesis of this lecture to our listeners?
The thrust of the lecture this evening will be to discuss what I think is an interesting question, namely, if you look at the historical record on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and you look at the documentary record on the human rights questions bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict, it's actually very uncomplicated and not controversial at all. There's a remarkable amount of agreement, a remarkable amount of consensus on the historical record, on the documentary record. And yet there's all of this apparent controversy and passionate disagreement when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict. You would think from public discussion that this is a very complex and complicated subject, whereas when you look at the documentary record and the historical record, it's not complicated at all. And so the question I'll be discussing this evening is, why is there so much controversy about something which is frankly not controversial?
Mm-hmm. Now, anti-Semitism and this term clearly plays a part in all of this. What is the role of that term there?
The main purpose of these claims of a new anti-Semitism, which, by the way, they come up roughly every 15 years or so, every time Israel comes under attack for its human rights record, whenever international pressures are put on Israel to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict diplomatically, whenever Israel faces a public relations debacle, as it did with the Second Intifada, the organizations supporting Israel, the apologists and the so-called supporters, they revive this extravaganza called the new anti-Semitism. You could see in 1974, the head of the ADL, the so-called Anti-Defamation League, the main so-called Jewish defense organization, the head of it back then was a fellow named Arnold Foster, and he and his colleague Benjamin Epstein, they put out a book, and the title was The New Anti-Semitism. And in 1981, the head of the ADL was a fellow named Nathan Perlmutter. He and his wife put out a book, and the title is The Real Anti-Semitism, and the claim is there's a new anti-Semitism. So this is a revival, what we're currently going through. The only thing that's really a little bit different about the current campaign is who's being targeted. It used to be that you used to target organizations which were pretty much on the left or had good solid records of courage, like the National Council of Churches. So they were called, in days gone by, the new anti-Semites. In the current campaign, which began around 2001, the main targets are very mainstream organizations. So Human Rights Watch is anti-Semitic, and Amnesty International is anti-Semitic, and all of the mainstream media are anti-Semitic. We're now reaching the sort of terminal phase of this lunacy where everybody in the world is anti-Semitic, because they're all saying the same thing, and the same thing they're saying happens to be called, in normal language, it's not called anti-Semitism, it's called the truth. And the truth is that Israel's record in the occupied territories is horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to follow up on that, with this new anti-Semitism, perhaps you could describe some of the implications. You mentioned a lot of these groups, which many would deem to be fairly mainstream groups, such as Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. What are the implications?
Well, the implications are basically twofold. Number one, it's used to discredit all criticism of Israel, the claim being that those who are expressing the criticism are covert or overt anti-Semites. And the second main aim is to turn Jews into the victims. So whereas in the case of Israel-Palestine, it's Jews who are the perpetrators, by making this claim of a new anti-Semitism, which according to the current head of the ADL, Abraham Foxman, I prefer to call him the Grand Dragon of the Jewish Citizens Council, Abraham Foxman, he claims that Jews are now facing a threat akin to, if not worse, than the one Jews faced in the late 1930s in Europe. Well, this is pure lunacy. This has nothing to do, but it's supposed to conjure up the image of Jews as being the victim. And it's very convenient. So instead of the real victims gaining attention, namely the Palestinians, it's the perpetrators who are now being turned into the victims. And it's spread everywhere. It's revolting flunky of the United States, Kofi Annan. He gives these speeches saying that there's nothing more important in the world today than to recognize the uniqueness of the Holocaust. Well, you would think somebody who's coming from Africa would raise his or her eyebrows a little about this notion of the uniqueness of the Holocaust. Africa has experienced its mass exterminations, and now the United Nations has declared January 27th Holocaust Day, and everybody in the world has to, on January 27th, I don't know, go into mourning or fast, who the hell knows what. This is all just, it's pitiful. The cowardice, the fear, the cravenness to the United States and these Jewish organizations. It's really a revolting display of human cowardice. It's terrible.
I guess since the discussion here is brought up of the Holocaust and so forth, Mr. Finkelstein, if you can tell us as a Jewish person, if you can explain to us what you believe is the place and responsibility of Jewish people in North America in regard to this oppression of the Palestinian people that is happening.
Well, first of all, I don't think these are specifically questions which, as a Jewish person, I should be answering. I am Jewish, but I don't think there's a particular Jewish perspective that ought to be sought. There's an ordinary moral perspective which any decent human being ought to support. On the other hand, I think there is a fair core to your question, which is that there's no question that the colossal suffering that Jews endured during World War II is being used, manipulated, and hijacked to justify the oppression of the Palestinians. And to the extent that it's being done in the name of Jews, then I think in the name of Jews, in the name of the historical suffering of Jews, then plainly there's a special responsibility among Jews to repudiate the exploitation of Jewish suffering for a evil cause. And in that respect, I think your question is quite accurate. I don't think there's a special perspective, but there is a special responsibility. When you're being used, or the suffering of your group is being used for an evil cause, then you have a special responsibility to say, as many Jews have said, not in my name.
This ties us up again with some of the experiences that we had here in Montreal, the Palestinian community or people that are working on Palestinian issue, you talked about people comparing the situation now that is the Jewish people are facing is compared to the 30s. Mm-hmm. That is something that was brought up here in 2002 when Netanyahu came to Concordia University. Mm-hmm. At the time, some of the Israeli lobby organizations called that day Kristallnacht again, mm-hmm. because one plane of glass broke. Such a weird thing. But I would like to ask, you know, something that is somehow connected to your book here. The you know, lately you have been talking and debunking of Dershowitz's book, The Case of Israel.
I think you should explain for your listeners, I'm not sure how well known he is in Canada, who is Alan Dershowitz and why I focused on his book. Would you like me to do that, or would you like to do that?
Well, I can. You can bring it up, but okay. What I wanted to ask is actually to put it in a larger context, because I'm sure you're sick of hearing, you know, people asking you that same question, mm-hmm. why and what's wrong with the book, but putting it in a larger context in what is happening to academic freedoms and the independence of what used to be called the sanctuary of thought, the university.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is a good question, and I can speak on a personal, practical level on that. My book came out, the latest book, Beyond Chutzpah, came out in late August after a huge battle. Professor Dershowitz of Harvard Law School and a prominent figure in American public life, he wrote a book entitled The Case for Israel, came out in 2003. It was a huge international bestseller, and I went through the book, and the book is a complete fraud from start to finish. There's a difference of opinion, perhaps, and where start begins. Some people think it's the first word of the first page in the book, and some people think it's the first name of the author that the fraud begins. I happen to be of the second persuasion. I think the fraud begins with the author's name. I don't think Alan Dershowitz wrote the book. In any case, a huge battle ensued for about a year, with Professor Dershowitz trying to suppress publication of the book. Eventually, he failed in his efforts, and the book came out. But the truth of the matter is, the book came out only in a very technical sense. That is to say, it was published, there's paper, there's a cover, and so forth. But so far as public life in the United States is concerned, the book never happened. There hasn't been a single interview. I haven't done a single mainstream interview. There hasn't been a single mainstream review of the book. Nothing. It's completely non-existent. I have to even say alternative radio, like my old friend Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, they didn't want to have me on, which was a big disappointment, I have to say. The only place I've been able to talk about the book and talk about the relevant issues have been college campuses. And so if you were to go to my website and look at my speaking engagements, you'll see it's college campus, college campus, college campus, college campus. And in fact, the college campuses are the last haven of open expression on this particular issue, which is unsurprising. And therefore, it's unsurprising why Jewish organizations have been claiming the past few years that the main manifestations of this so-called new anti-Semitism are college campuses, because it's college campuses which where the kinds of fear and control are not as forceful as everywhere else. I have to say, to the credit of Arab organizations on college campuses, who face all sorts of pressures. Every time I'm invited to speak, you would think there is a hysteria. Actually, just today, if you look at the Harvard University website, the Harvard Crimson, they have this big editorial that Finkelstein should be allowed to speak. Because when I spoke there last Thursday, there were all these hecklers. Really pretty obnoxious, I have to say. So the Arab organizations, in the case of Harvard, it was the Students for Justice in Palestine, and they have found the courage. And I have to say it is courage, because they come under lots and lots of pressure. And in places like Harvard Law School, it's career destroying. It is career destroying to invite me. That's the only place left. Mainstream radio, forget television, I mean television, it's out of the question. Mainstream radio, mainstream reviews, you know, absolute zero. You know, I was once on CBC. I debated this fellow, I can't remember, from the Canadian Jewish Congress, a complete imbecile. And the mail, the emails had started to come in, and you knew, and I'm perfectly aware of it, that it's the first time and it's the last time. I'll never be on again. And many people have tried to get me on CBC and tried very hard and talk to people there. It's out of the question. Not because what I say is particularly controversial. It's not. It's completely within the mainstream of what human rights organizations have to say. It's because mostly people are just terrified of these organizations and these hoodlums and thugs who browbeat everyone into silence.
Just to say something here to bring it up, maybe I would like you to concentrate on, again, the university. It seems to be, as you said, to be the last frontier for this battle on the truth, on human rights, on what is happening in Palestine.
I don't think the university in general, but I do think that on the university campus, if student organizations, and it's almost always student organizations, show a sufficient amount of courage, I managed to squeeze my way in. But I wouldn't say it's in general. It's not like it's not like I'm getting invitations from departments or from the university itself. It happens this year at University of Chicago and at Yale University. I did get official sponsorship, but that's very unusual. It's generally a handful of decent students who are committed to justice in the Israel-Palestine conflict, who get me in. Incidentally, since it's said I get these huge honorariums, in most cases, I've spoken at, I think, 11 colleges since October 1st. I think my total honorariums, which don't even, in many cases, cover my cab fare, came to about $1,400. We're not talking about big bucks.
We're speaking right now with Professor Norman Finkelstein, who's here in the CKUT studio. You're listening to Off the Hour. And just to remind people, Professor Finkelstein will be giving a lecture tonight at McGill University. It starts at 7:30 p.m. in the Stewart Biology Building, 1205 Dr. Penfield. We're going to break for some music and come right back with Professor Finkelstein. Swan, 5:25 p.m. and we're back on Off the Hour, CKUT 90.3 FM. Here with us in studio, we have our guest, Professor Norman G. Finkelstein, who will be giving a lecture tonight at McGill University, starting at 7:30 p.m., again in the Stewart Biology Building, 1205 Dr. Penfield, on the ground floor. This is a talk sponsored by Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill, as well as Palestinian and Jewish Unity, the Canada-Palestine Foundation of Quebec, ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, Montreal Information, Montreal Palestine, and the Montreal Planet Magazine. We'd like to invite our listeners to call in to the studio if they have questions for Professor Finkelstein. We can be reached here at 514-398-4616. So we return to our discussion with Professor Finkelstein. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Now, you were, as we mentioned before, the author of 5 books, but also quite a prominent scholar and commentator on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One of your books is The Holocaust Industry. And what I find interesting is that both your parents were survivors of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. Can you talk a bit about how the experience of your parents has influenced the work you've been doing.
Well, first of all, I have to make a distinction. Whatever I say on scholarly matters is totally unrelated to my background, and it shouldn't be based on my background. There's an accusation that's made that I use the my, so to speak, Holocaust credentials in order to bolster my case. And I would say, to the extent that people do take me more seriously on account of my, so to speak, Holocaust credentials, I think it's wrong. The facts stand or fall on the basis of whether the argument is right or not, and not on one's background. There's an expression that many people know, a broken clock is right twice a day. So you can be a complete loony, but still, twice a day, you're right, you know? And so those shouldn't be, I think, in political discussions, those shouldn't be grounds for judging the merits of an argument. Since you're asking me a personal question now and not a political one, personal question, of course, it's perfectly relevant and perfectly justified. So in answer to that question, just to be clear about the background, both my mother and father were in the Warsaw Ghetto until from September 1939 to April 1943. When the Nazis suppressed the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, the survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto were sent to concentration camps. My mother and father were sent to Majdanek concentration camp. My father eventually ended up in Auschwitz concentration camp, and he was in the Auschwitz death march. He was liberated by the Americans. My mother ended up in two slave labor camps, and she was liberated by the Russians. After the war, they were both in what were called DP, displaced people's camps in Austria, which is where they met. Every single member of my mother and father's family, every single member was exterminated. So growing up, I had no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, no grandparents, no nothing. We were just, as my mother used to remind us every time I wanted to attend a demonstration and my mother was sure I was going to get shot. She would always remind us, we're only five people in the world, so don't go. That was, you know, I can understand, she's a mother. As to how it influenced me, I'm not going to go into all of the personal items of that experience. I would just say, at the risk of sounding, I'm not sure if the word is conceited, but one thing I'm very sure of myself, and that's based on the basis of my parents' experience, that short of a bullet to my head, there's no way nobody can stop me. I'm not because I'm so confident of my beliefs, but because unless you can show me my beliefs are wrong, I'm going to stick hard to them until the end. I am unbuyable, and that I'm sure of, and that's because of my parents' experience. Because my parents' general view, as my mother used to say, of course there are a handful of beasts in the world, to whom she was referring with the Nazis, but so that didn't surprise her that you would encounter in life beasts. It was everybody else that kind of surprised her, as she used to say, that the rest of the world was silent. It wasn't the Nazi behavior that really surprised her. It was the behavior of all those who were not Nazis, and what she, you know, felt to be the silence in the face of the terrible things that were happening. And that left a deep impression on me. The main lesson being that I will never be like everyone else, and there is no way that I can be bought. And I know that, and that's not a boast. You know, it would sound like a boast if I were your age, but I'm now going on 52 years on this planet, and I have a track record. and people say many terrible things about me, some of which are probably true. I'm no angel. But one thing nobody has ever said, and one thing which anyone who knows me knows simply can't be true, and the one thing that's never said about me is I'm not for sale. And that's the main lesson I learned from my parents, not to be for sale. And I'm not. I've made mistakes, for sure. I've made big mistakes, as a matter of fact. But those mistakes were born of good faith, and they were errors. It wasn't, I wasn't being mercenary, and I wasn't doing it for mercenary motives.
Moving over to Israel-Palestine, which made international headlines throughout late August of this year during Israel's withdrawal of the settlements in the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. Much of the North American mainstream media hailed this as a step forward for peace in the region. However, you've written quite differently. Can you explain what you understand to be the real story behind the Gaza disengagement?
Well, first of all, you know, the whole Gaza thing was like a Steven Spielberg epic. I wouldn't be surprised if the Israelis had him, had called him in for advice on how to stage this Cecil B. DeMille-sized extravaganza. Probably nothing seen like it since, you know, Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments or something like that. And the second point is, my view is not at all, you know, unique. You look at what human rights organizations have to say. On August 19th, Human Rights Watch issued a statement, and the statement said there's no end to the occupation of Gaza. They said that if you're inside Gaza or you redeploy on its periphery, nothing has changed. And in fact, the principle is understood by any rational human being. If the jailers in the prison throw the keys to the prisoners, enabling the prisoners to get out of the cells, but then the jailers redeploy on the periphery of the prison and shut tight the gates, well, the prisoners are still in prison. Nothing has changed. Yes, it's true, they're no longer confined to their cells. They can move freely within the prison. But the fact that they're still in prison hasn't changed. In fact, as uncontroversial a person as James Wolfensohn, who is the special envoy of the so-called quartet for Israel-Palestine, Wolfensohn wrote a letter 2 weeks ago in which he says, quote, "Israel is acting as if the withdrawal never happened," which is exactly correct because the withdrawal didn't ever happen. That's simply a, some theatrics by the media, heart-rending scenes of these poor settlers who have to leave the places they were illegally occupying for 40 years and wreaking mayhem and wrecking the lives of the indigenous population. And they were being given $150,000 to $400,000 to relocate everywhere, but our hearts were supposed to be broken over that. So it was nice theater. As to the prospects for Gaza, the prospects are horrible. The world's leading authority on the Gaza is a senior researcher at Harvard named Sarah Roy. And Sarah Roy analyzed it. You can look in the current issue of the London Review of Books, the November 4th issue, I think. It's a very long article, and she writes that Gaza and the Palestinians remain imprisoned. Gaza remains an imprisoned enclave. And the most likely scenario is things are going to get worse there. Israel is not allowing, before the disengagement, about 6,000, 6,500 Palestinians from Gaza were allowed to enter Israel each day for work. By September, it was down to 100. By October, it was down to zero. They're imprisoning them there and waiting for them to just, reach points of desperation. As for the real story of Gaza is, the real story is that Gaza was simply used as a diversion for the complete destruction of the West Bank. As far as we can see now, there are several processes occurring simultaneously. Israel's construction of the wall will take in about 10% of the West Bank, including its most fertile land and its crucial water resources. The wall will divide the West Bank into two, a northern sector and a southern sector. Israel is now implementing what Betzalel, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, what Betzalel calls an apartheid-like road regime, prohibiting Palestinians on most of the roads, which are now designated for Jews only. And the whole of the West Bank is being broken up into three fragments, disconnected fragments, which will be surrounded by Jewish settlements. Overall, for anyone who's familiar with the Bantustans, it very much resembles the Bantustans in South Africa during the apartheid era. They were composed of what were called major and minor fragments surrounded by white South African settlements. And it's very similar to now what's happening in the West Bank. As to what will happen to the Palestinians, my guess is Israel is now hoping that Palestinian life will become so destitute and so desperate that quietly and without fanfare, they're going to gradually disappear. And I think there's probably a good chance of that happening. The obvious analogy is what happened in Lebanon, where there was a huge Palestinian refugee population, but the Lebanese put very strict controls on the work to which Palestinians were eligible. So there was something like 22 categories of work which no Palestinian was permitted. And what happened was the refugee population in Lebanon, without any fanfare, without any public protest, it just radically depleted, with Palestinians finding a way to make their way to Europe. And so the actual, if you look at the official statistics, it's supposed to be like 600,000 or so Palestinian refugees in the camps, but the actual number now is down to like 100,000 or so. They disappeared. And I think that's what Israel is hoping is going to happen in the West Bank, that life will become so absolutely intolerable, so completely unbearable, that without fanfare, the Palestinians are gradually going to disappear. Now, it's a long process, but Zionists have always been very good at seeing the long term. They have an excellent balance. And when I say Zionists, I mean the old school, and Sharon is part of the old school. He's not like these people like Netanyahu, who are just, you know, pretty much these corrupt crooks who don't care about Zionism or anything. They just care about one-ism, me-ism. The old school people like Sharon, they are Zionists. And the old school was always able to balance the long-term goals with the short-term victories. They had a very good sense of how to proceed in the what they used to call goat by goat, dunam by dunam. Dunam is the measure of land. How to do goat by goat, dunam by dunam, do these incremental short-term victories, always keeping the larger vision in mind. And, you know, after 120 years, they did very well, for sure, given what they started with. And I think they still have the long-term vision. Gradually, slowly, they'll force all the Palestinians out and make it an all-Jewish Palestine. I don't think it's altogether far-fetched.
You spoke of some of these images that we were seeing in the media of the settlers being taken out of their homes in Gaza.
By the way, that was all such a complete farce, because all the Israeli army had to do was announce, on August 1st, the army is leaving. You will have no protection. You 8,000 settlers are now going to be left amid 1.5 million raving Arab fanatics. They would have all packed their bags and left by July 31st. They would have all been gone. It didn't require anything. Just an announcement. Goodbye. It was all complete theater.
But these images that we're seeing of that disengagement. Mm-hmm.
It's very funny when you think of it, because they couldn't have survived a day without the army.
What were the implications of those images from North American audiences?
The implications were, it was all pure premeditation. And premeditation was that Israel had made a phenomenal gesture towards peace and towards ending the occupation and towards the two-state settlement. And now it was in the court of the Palestinians to reciprocate and make a comparable gesture. Unfortunately, the Palestinians' leadership is completely and totally corrupt. It's the most wretched leadership. It's not even a leadership, It's just a bunch of flunkies for the United States and Israel. Probably the most wretched example of what's supposed to be a leadership. And they played along with the game. So the chief crook in Gaza, this fellow named Dahlan, an American-trained CIA agent, so far as I can see, he called it, the name of the campaign was, quote, when the Gaza disengagement, we're reclaiming our jewel. I mean, you really got to be kidding. Reclaiming our jewel. Gaza is a horror story. Experiencing, as Sarah Roy said, the worst depression in modern history. And it didn't start off very well to begin with, reclaiming our jewel, because he has to show that he's accomplished something. In the short term, you'll fool people. There's that famous line by Lincoln, you can fool all of the people some of the time, you can fool some of the people all of the time. All of the people some of the time. But you can fool all the people all the time. And Palestinians have always counted on fooling all the people all the time. The leadership. So-called leadership. So at the beginning they maintained, this was a big victory. No victory at all, It is true they ridded themselves of those wretched settlers. That's true, but it's not going to amount to very much in the end.
Well, since you talked about the future, mm-hmm. and what you think could be the future, a lot of people see that what's happening in Iraq and what is going to happen in Syria and Lebanon mm-hmm. and Iran as... very, very connected.
It's not just there now. Now it's Europe. Yeah. I mean, it's very hard not to see the connections between Iraq and what's happening now in France, and it's spreading. That's a big problem brewing. It's a big problem. I'm sure they're all cursing the Americans, because they're saying they stirred up all this trouble, and there's real problems now in France. And it looks like it's spreading. So I think it's becoming a transcontinental problem now.
Well, how do you see that? I mean, Israel cannot be stopped.
Can be stopped. I don't agree with that. I think that there's been no real serious efforts, apart from the first Intifada from 88 to 90. Apart from that, there's been no serious effort to stop Israel. I remain completely convinced that with a serious leadership, Israel could have been stopped. The heroic resistance of little villages like Belin, had that resistance been organized on a national level by a real leadership, Israel was going to would have had a very big problem. But there's no leadership.
Maybe to reframe my question, what mm-hmm. I wanted to ask is, you compared it to South Africa mm-hmm. in many of the situations of talking of apartheid. The basic problem that a lot of us as activists mm-hmm. on Palestinian human rights here in North America face is that the South African anti-apartheid movement did not have a huge lobby that has a lot of pressure in the media and on the government to face. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we are in a 50 years behind trying to play catch up with the Israeli lobby here in North America. Somehow, we were able to do that, some of that work. That is why we could, some of us argue that all this pressure on the campuses since 2001 and the recreation of anti-Semitism is because of the effectiveness mm-hmm. of the academic discrediting of Zionism mm-hmm. and its myths. But if this is being accelerated in a way to expand the war in the Middle East, for it to drag attention away from what is happening in Palestine, how do we work with that?
Well, you know, there are no magic formulas about how you do these things. There are new technologies, but still people have to do, even with internet and so forth, you have to do the old-fashioned organizing, which is the only way that you can stop these folks and their plans and their machinations. I think there's always this tendency to conjure up this all-powerful lobby. They have a lot of power, no question. They're ruthless, no question. Well organized, no question. On those scores, there'll be no dispute between us. But I think there's a tendency to overlook that they have spectacular weaknesses, because their whole edifice is built on lies, and that's why they're so terrified of any public discussion, because the truth is not on their side. In fact, none of the truth is on their side. In fact, their case is pitiful, which is why they have to resort to these kinds of ruthless tactics to silence opposition. Well, that means our side has quite powerful weapons. It has the weapon of truth. It has the weapon of justice. But you have to learn how to wield those weapons. You have to have organization. You have to have commitment. You have to have conviction. You have to have a little bit. This isn't, you know, a totalitarian regime. It's not Latin America. Your body parts don't get chopped off if you dissent. You have to show a little bit of courage. And I have to emphasize, very little. If you're willing to do those things, organize, study, show a little courage and conviction, I think that the struggle could probably be won. I'm not so pessimistic. The problem has been all along that there's no organization. The so-called leadership is monumentally corrupt. Those have been the main problems. I don't know who would have won in this battle, because I don't think our side ever summoned up more than maybe 2% of its potential. Now, it's possible, you never know, if they summoned up 100%, they would still have lost. I can't predict that. But what I can say for certain is they did not make the best fight of it. No, it was just, it's so wretched, it defies belief. The levels of cowardice, corruption. You know, you try to get over a Palestinian spokesperson from the occupied territories just to come here. Honorarium, $15,000. First class airfare. That's the best over there. And I know the people. That's the best. If you had asked a Zionist in 1930s, somebody says, Ben Gurion, they want you to speak at some little synagogue in the Catskills in New York. He'd tell his wife, Paula, pack me a salami sandwich, I'm going to the Catskills. You know, not what goes on here. The level of corruption is just, is breathtaking. And you can't win a struggle like that. You know, it's a cliche that the Palestinians have all the corruption of a post-state before they have a state. You know, you can't win that way. And I think it's always an excuse to talk about the Zionists and their power. That's an excuse. Yes, they are formidable. Yes, I'll give you grant everything you have to say. But our side has powerful weapons also, and they've never been exploited. there are just shelves and shelves of excellent human rights reports by very courageous and decent people, totally mainstream. Nobody reads them. Nobody cites them. Nobody does that kind of work. It's work. You know? The big, in my opinion, among the big tragedies of the Palestine question was precisely that became the focus of world attention. Had it been something like East Timor, only decent people were involved in it. But because Palestine became a focus, there were all these NGOs that went in, and everyone turned it into a business, and we have to heal our psychological wounds. And there were all of these conferences with lots of food and lots of good time. But you know that if you want to get to those conferences, you have to say the right thing. So for like 10 years, you had to be pro-Oslo if you wanted to get to one of those conferences. And everybody started, well, I don't blame them. They want to get out of prison. So they started to toe the party line and, oh, we're all getting together to heal our psychic wounds. You know, it's pure crap. Or it's all about misunderstandings. There were no misunderstandings. Israel wanted Palestine. The Palestinians wanted Palestine. It wasn't complicated, you know, but it all became all the rot of corruption started to spread and set in. They lost, you know. But I don't think, you know, conjuring up this Zionist bogey, I don't think it's not nearly the full explanation.
We're speaking with Norman Finkelstein, who's here live in the CKUT studios. Professor Finkelstein will be giving a lecture tonight at McGill University, starting at 7:30 p.m. It's entitled Israel and Palestine, Misusing Anti-Semitism, Abusing History. That's at McGill in the Stewart Biology Building, 1205 Dr. Penfield, on the ground floor. Professor Finkelstein, we'd like to thank you for being
our
with
pleasure.
Us today. We're going to take a break for some music and come right back. You're listening to Off the Hour, CKUT 90.3 FM.
What will you remember when you recall your 16th year? The horrid sound of helicopters